to not just be a passive analyst of the data, but being the one that says, like, I want to take this picture with a rover on another planet. Like, that is really, really cool. I'm not gonna lie.
Today's episode, I speak with a person that is best described as a professional Martian. My guest is a former mission operator with the Mars Rovers and a planetary scientist focusing on Martian geomorphology, as well as both Martian and terrestrial imaging. And today, my guest discusses what it feels like to be able to control rovers and orbiters on an entirely alien planet 100-odd million kilometers away. And strangely, my guest has been enchanted and driven to a future with Mars for a very, very long time, and discusses why she and the rest of us have such a desire towards Mars unlike any other planet. We discuss the ins and outs of the Mars rover operations, such as the goals and steps involved, and we also talk about the philosophical aspects as well as the technological successes associated with space exploration. We also obviously chat about the big question, putting people on Mars, and how the face of this goal has changed with the likes of Elon Musk's SpaceX and Blue Origin. Lastly, my guest lays out how Earth imaging is done, as well as some of the ethical considerations of our increasing technology and increasing ability to monitor and image our planet. So, with that in mind, please welcome the professional Martian, Tanya Harrison.
Mind-bending chemicals.
I don't care, he wants to kill me.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
Oh, planets are in space. I want to study Mars. I should be an astronomer. So I went into astronomy and physics as an undergraduate, and I realized maybe 2 or 3 years in that if I wanted to study Mars, I actually should have been a geologist. Wow. So I didn't feel like paying money to stay an extra year as an undergraduate to change degrees. So I switched degrees in grad school instead. So even though my master's degree says Earth and Environmental Sciences, I spent that whole time studying Mars. So it's a little bit of a misnomer. Mm-hmm. And then after that, I left academia for about 4 years and ended up working for a company that builds cameras for different space missions for NASA. Most of the color cameras on the rovers, cameras on the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. And if you've seen any of the really amazing pictures coming back from Jupiter the last couple of years, we built that camera too.
Wow.
Yeah, they build a lot of cameras.
Really? Yeah.
And so, yeah, I worked there for about 4 years and then decided to go back to grad school to get a PhD in geology with a specialization in planetary science. So, again, my whole thing ended up being focused on Mars with a little bit of work on what we call terrestrial analogs. So places on Earth that are like places on Mars.
That's sort of a strange conclusion that you kind of made there, which was that, you know, if you wanted to know about Mars, if you wanted to sort of work on Mars, you actually had to study sort of more geology than what you were doing originally. How did you get to that sort of conclusion?
I had been looking for people to work on with people to work with in research at the university, and I couldn't find anybody in the astronomy department that was doing anything that had to do with Mars. They actually sent me over to the Earth and Space Sciences department.
Wow.
And yeah, at least in our astronomy department at the University of Washington, people were pretty focused on, like, you know, star clusters and extragalactic stuff, you know, more typical astronomy. So I went over to Earth and Space Sciences department and ended up working with a group there that was doing mapping of layers in the northern polar cap of Mars. And I thought it was really, really cool. And they were the ones that nudged me in the geo direction. They were like, yeah, if you want to change fields, you should probably shift more to geology. So that was really helpful. I'm glad I got linked up with those people, because otherwise I still enjoy doing astronomical research, but I might have stayed in that track a little bit more if I hadn't found these people to work with early
on. Gone down slightly the wrong route, I suppose, yeah.
Yeah.
But it's strange, because it seems like you've had at least an affinity for Mars for quite some time if you had really sought out sort of a specific direction.
Yeah, I mean, I came in, like, I was 15 when I started college, and so I came in, like, raring to go. I was like, how do I study Mars? What do I need to do? And I didn't find the right people early on enough, I think, to point me in the right direction. And it might have just been Let's have you study kind of the broad stuff, and then we'll figure out how to funnel you in the right direction. So, you know, first couple of years of any of those degrees, regardless mm-hmm. of where you're doing, geo, astro, it's like lots of physics classes, lots of calculus classes. So either way, it still would have been fine. I just didn't get like the hard rock geology in early on. Mm-hmm. But I did start taking geology classes later, right before I graduated. Like I was really interested in ice and snow and avalanches, mm-hmm. so I took glaciology. And that's what really got me into like specifically glacial and paraglacial stuff on Mars. So things that are around ice.
Mm-hmm. That's, I mean, I don't know what sort of reflection this is for you, but like most, I feel like most of the academics that I've spoken to in the time of the podcast, they more have a story of like stumbling into the field, you know, like they've sort of tripped into it. Whereas you've sort of like planned and cooked for quite some time. Why do you think it is that you've sort of had this love for Mars and this dream for a while? What is it about Mars that has sort of drawn you towards it?
I was initially drawn in by the Pathfinder mission. So when okay. Pathfinder landed and Sojourner started driving around on Mars, I was like right around the age where it's really impressionable in terms of what you might want to figuring out for your career.
Right. Okay.
And I thought it was really cool that we could drive. This was the first rover that we had ever sent beyond the moon.
So Pathfinder was the first one, was it?
Sojourner with the Pathfinder.
Sorry, my mistake. Sojourner. Okay.
Yeah. And so the fact that we had the ability to drive a shoebox sized rover around on another planet just blew my mind. And I knew at that point, I was like, I want to work on these rovers.
Yeah.
And my goal became very singularly focused. It's like, how do I get into a position where I get to drive a rover on Mars?
That's a pretty fair goal, because, you know, one of the things about, I think the rover missions in general, there's something special about the rover missions in general, I think, like almost like a philosophical point of view for society as a whole that sort of, that took people's spirits in a way that I think, you know, a lot of other parts of astronomy that might be seemingly sort of unimportant for certain people, the rover mission sort of has taken everyone's spirit a certain amount. And I don't know, I wonder why that is. Do you think it is maybe some of that physical aspect that you were talking about that made you love it, like the fact that we can actually go up there and drive something along, someone can actually control it? Yeah, what do you think it is that about the rover missions that have sort of stolen the hearts of people so much?
That's an interesting question. I think like the way that we operate the rovers is not really all that different from how we operate the satellites. But okay. for some reason, the rovers garner so much more adoration yeah. and attention. And the only reason I can think of is that they might be easier for us to anthropomorphize. I mean, they have eyes, they have arms. We're basically having them do stuff on another planet as a proxy for what we would do if we were there. They're,
right.
you know, picking up rocks. Well, not exactly picking up rocks, but as much as the rover can do. Yeah, yeah. They're looking at them. They're drilling them. They're digging little holes for us. Mm-hmm. And I think that's easier for us to relate to than a satellite that's flying through the vastness of space, you know, toward Jupiter or something like that. Mm. And they encounter a lot more in sort of like the day-to-day trials and tribulations of what could happen to a person. Like if we're on Mars, the rovers are experiencing weather. They have power issues sometimes. They have a much more regular cadence of things happening compared to like, you know, Juno, for example. We launched Juno and it takes a good 6 years to get to Jupiter. So you have a bunch of fanfare and then nothing for a really long time. And then it comes by and it takes these really beautiful pictures, and then the public doesn't hear that much about them. But there's a lot more to keep people engaged, I think, when it comes to the rovers. There's like new pictures every day, and like you just want to know what the rover is doing, where is it, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's something I've never thought about, the human aspect of the rovers more than, because, you know, when you think about them, you don't think about them in like a robotic sense necessarily, like you would, like you just said, a satellite. You do have a certain sort of relationship. And, you know, as humans, we sort of have a different relationship with Mars compared to anything else in space in general, right? So there's something to do with that too. Like for years and years, we've had a fascination with Mars historically, on religious basis, things like that. Literature that's come out around Mars, you know, a friend of mine who's sort of like a science historian, you know, he did a podcast, he has his own sort of science history podcast, and he did a podcast about Mars and just about the strange stuff that has happened with Mars across history. And, you know, I wonder what the reasons are for that. I suppose it's one of the closest planets. That's probably one of the things. What else do you think could be the reason that humans, I guess, are so mystified by Mars more so than maybe the rest of space?
I think it's held a special... It's held a special point of attention to us for a long time. Like when you look at Mars in the sky, it is so different from anything else. Like just with your naked eye, it's bright red. It's very striking. And so, you know, you start out with these mythological ideas of like, oh, this is something that has to do with the god of war. And then you move on to the point where we start being able to look at it through ground-based telescopes with folks like Percival Lowell, who thought all of these light and dark shades he was seeing on the surface were canals built by aliens. And it gave us this nice pop culture idea of maybe our next door neighbor has this thriving civilization on it. That's really cool. Let's go check it out. Let's go meet our neighbors. And unfortunately, you know, we got there and it turned out to be a bunch of craters and it wasn't anything like what we were expecting. But it's a different kind of interesting now. There's a lot of stuff on Mars that is really similar to Earth, but we don't know what happened to things like the water and the volcanic activity and stuff like that, that made it more Earth-like in the past. And now those features are all gone. Like the volcanoes aren't erupting today. There's still ice all over the place, but there's not, you know, oceans or rivers or anything like that. And so I think we just have this fascination with life elsewhere in the solar system or elsewhere in the universe. And Mars has been sort of the focus of that for a really long time. Other places we've gone, you know, there's no life on the moon. We flew by Venus and there used to be all these sci-fi ideas that Venus was maybe this jungle planet inhabited by Amazonian-esque women.
Yeah.
definitely not. It's really hot and covered in sulfuric acid.
It's not going to happen.
Maybe there's like bacteria living in the atmosphere or something, but really, really unlikely. So Mars has just been like the most probable candidate in the solar system for this stuff until very, very recently. And so I think it's just fascinated us to want to know, like, Mars used to be so much more like Earth. What was it like when it was like what we know?
One of physicist Alan Duffy, who's Australian physicist, he's been on the podcast too. One thing he said was, you know, when we're sort of discussing aliens and thinking about aliens and life elsewhere, like what we're secretly wondering about is like us. Do you know what I mean? Like we're secretly wondering if the evolutionary dice was sort of rolled a different way. How could it have turned out for us? How is life for others? Are we that special? Are we not that special? So it's like it's sort of in some way like a selfish wondering, because we're maybe sort of comparing it with ourselves. Now, because you have worked with Mars for this time, obviously with all jobs, there's a certain amount of sort of, monotony is not the right word, but you see it more in like a clinical manner. Do you still have sort of like a mysticism associated with Mars when you are doing work associated with Mars?
Oh, absolutely. I remember like when I was working on like operations day to day, like for Opportunity or the cameras on the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, I would walk to work and I would feel like dancing on the way in, because you just never knew what you were going to see or what was going to happen, either good or bad. And it was just so exciting. And it was nice to feel that way even after having done it for like 10 years. You still felt excited to go into work every day. And I think it's because there's still so much for us to learn about Mars. If it was just the same thing day after day after day and we weren't learning anything new, I could see feeling burnt out at that point. But I mean, every little picture that comes in, you might have, you know, long drive periods where you're not necessarily seeing anything that's like mind blowing, but then suddenly you come across a rock that tells you about the entire history of the lake bed that we're driving in with the Curiosity rover, for example. And that's a really, really amazing feeling.
Yeah, of course it is. Well, because one of the significant things as well is like with you doing that kind of thing, I mean, you're like the first person in history to have ever seen it in that sort of light, right? If you're seeing something sort of for the first time from the rover, like you are literally like an explorer in that sense. So the excitement you have is pretty high up compared to a lot of people and a lot of their jobs, I suppose. So in terms of sort of a perfect segue as well, what were you doing at your time working with the Mars rovers. What was your role and sort of what was the goal at the time?
So I worked on, depending on which rover, I worked on different operations for the color cameras that were the eyes of the rover. Mm-hmm. So for Curiosity, I worked on the mass cameras, the Mars hand lens imager, which is the one at the end of the arm that we used to take the selfies.
Ah. And then
the Mars descent imager, which is the one on the belly of the rover that took the images mm-hmm. as it was landing. And then on Opportunity, I worked on the panchromatic cameras, which are like that one's version of the mass cameras, so the color eyes of that rover. And I usually work as something that's called a payload downlink lead, which is a fancy way of saying I look at the images when they come back from Mars. And then you're kind of looking at them from two standpoints. One is the camera itself functioning properly? You know, are the temperature ranges good? Do the pixels all look like they're okay? Is there anything wonky, like technically, with the camera? And then you're also looking at it from the standpoint of a geologist. Is there anything in this image that's telling us something important about the history of Mars?
Right.
Or something, you know, really cool, like maybe we caught a dust devil going by. Or, hey, there's something over there. We should change our course and drive over and, like, drill that rock or something like that. Mm-hmm. And that's a really cool position to be in. Because even if you're a scientist that works on Mars or studying anywhere else in the solar system with these missions, a lot of the time you are analyzing data that has been taken by these rovers or these satellites, but you weren't necessarily involved in capturing that information. And this was one thing I learned actually during my time as an astronomer. I spent a lot of time actually collecting and processing data from telescopes. And I realized that I liked getting my hands dirty in the data and actually being involved in the process of operating these things. Mm-hmm. So to not just be a passive analyst of the data, but being the one that says, like, I want to take this picture with a rover on another planet. Like, that is really, really cool. I'm not going to lie. So it's like, you already have a small subset of people that are Mars scientists, and then you have an even smaller subset of those people that are actually operating these spacecraft like every single day.
Mm-hmm. So you were sort of responsible for making like the geologist's analysis of what was going on and then making sort of differences as you went.
Yeah, more so when I worked on the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter than with the rovers, because with the rovers, the team is much larger and there's,
of course,
everything is kind of done by committee, which probably sounds less exciting to people than they would imagine it is. But you literally spend all day on like telecon after telecon telecon deciding like, what are you going to do? Because the resources are so limited and your time is so limited. And so you spend a lot of time adjudicating what's going to happen. Mm. Whereas working on the satellites, my job, basically, I could come in, put on headphones, start playing music, and sit at my computer and target these cameras for hours and hours on end and look at the images that came back every day without much consultation with other people. And that was, I think, a much more powerful feeling, because it's like, that for this week, because you would kind of trade off week after week with the couple other people in the group that I worked in. It's like, for this week, I essentially have total control of this camera on this satellite orbiting Mars.
Yeah. And for what reason was that so different as well? Is it just because the rovers were more of sort of a expensive investment? So actually any sort of change in route or anything like that would cost a lot more money? Or why was it so much more free for the reconnaissance orbiter?
There's a lot more planning when it comes in with the rover, because a lot of the time you can only do one thing at a time. So if you're doing anything on any given day because of usually power restrictions, you could drive, or you could take pictures, or you could take a sample, but you don't necessarily have enough power to do all of those things in the same day. And you have this long-term goal of, you know, maybe getting to a specific destination or analyzing a specific target. And so you have to make a bunch of plans to reach that goal. Whereas with at least the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, a lot of our goal was just map the planet at this high resolution and do that in an efficient manner. And so you don't really need to have all these committee type meetings, because if my camera is taking pictures, the camera over here can still take pictures as well. We don't need to necessarily talk to each other to make that happen. Right. But on the rover, like if I want to take pictures, but the person over here wants to take a drill sample, like, we can't do those at the same time, so okay. We have to talk to each other.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I suppose giving you that sort of free rein, I mean, in some ways, like, it's giving the responsibility to you, so... if you give the responsibility to the expert, then maybe you might find out more than if you have to go through this sort of Mars red tape that you're discussing, a lot of stuff that you have to trip over.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting to think about it with you as well, because you've, like we said, you've sort of been interested in Mars for such a long time, and then you worked with Mars for such a long time too. Did you feel that, I suppose, your thoughts and ideas about the importance of learning more about Mars, about potentially humans visiting Mars, your thoughts and ideas about that at the beginning of all this versus at the very end of that, do you think that sort of your ideas and philosophies changed much, or?
I think maybe the only thing that changed over time was mm-hmm. when I was younger, I definitely had the enthusiasm about wanting to discover if there was life on Mars or not, and really hoping that there was. And I think I gained more appreciation over time for the idea that even if Mars didn't have life on it, it's still a really important place to explore as its own entity. And it's maybe even more important to find out that Mars didn't have life, because we know that it had all the conditions for it to thrive, at least life as we know it, at the same point in history that life was arising on Earth. So if that happened on Earth, but it didn't happen on Mars, and we had the same conditions at the same time, what caused that difference? And I think that might be even more interesting than the idea of, okay, you know, bacterial life formed on both of these planets, and then Mars very obviously went through this transition where it was warm and wet, and now it's cold and dry, and we know life is not really capable of surviving there today, at least on the surface. Maybe there's some pockets underground where it's warm and there's some liquid water. But yeah, if there never was life, like, why did that happen?
That's a good point. That's a really good point that I hadn't thought about. It's everyone's always, that's always the thing that they're sort of banking on, is finding life. But it would be extremely interesting is why isn't there, especially if it was so similar at a certain period of time. You know, it's strange for me because astronomy is one of those weird sciences, more so than I think almost any other science, because it's like, it's the most loved science, I think, like what people like the most, like the images of stars and things like that people love so much. Yet it's also kind of like the most tenuous in the way that you don't necessarily get a new technology or something direct as you would maybe if you were someone studying material science or something. Like, for example, you can easily see the path that makes a better material for a building. but strangely, I feel like Mars exploration cops kind of gets quite a lot of like trouble and flack from people who think that sort of it's a waste of money, right? Mm-hmm. So people might not complain about astronomy as a whole, but specifically Mars, they think is quite a waste of money. And it's always like the classic thing that people say, like, why are we spending money up there when we have problems down here and that kind of thing. How did your reflections on that sort of idea change over your time working with them? And I suppose, what do you say to those people that say that too? I'm sure you've answered that question 1,001 times as well.
No, it's a really great question. And I feel like it's one that we as scientists have the responsibility to answer, because a lot of this is being funded by taxpayer dollars. And you're right, it is a little nebulous to quantify, because it's hard to say, you know, we developed this technology for this rover and it led to this thing that you use in your daily life. That is the case for a lot of stuff maybe that we've done on the space station, like, or things that we've developed specifically for human spaceflight. There are applications for that on the Earth. But for Mars exploration, there's some stuff that we can take and apply, like the technology that we need to develop for humans to survive on Mars and to turn Mars into a habitable environment are things that would be useful here on Earth for things like what we call geo-remediation. Mm-hmm. So making Earth more habitable, or, you know, bringing Earth back to being a habitable place for us and dealing with the effects of climate change. But a lot of it is also nebulous in terms of things like inspiration. You have a lot of people that are coming into science and technology fields who don't necessarily end up working on these missions, but they were inspired to come into STEM because of NASA or things like that. Mm-hmm. But then from a more direct standpoint, these programs generate a lot of jobs. So NASA alone employs about 20,000 people.
Wow.
And that's not just the engineers. I mean, you have accountants, you have janitors, you have administrative staff. Like, a lot of people are required to make this stuff happen. And that doesn't include, like, from that, all the people that are employed at universities and national labs and places where they're being funded by NASA to do work on these missions, to develop instruments, to process the data, to write papers. And then these missions often take a very long time. So Curiosity, for example, was being developed for 10 years before it got to Mars, and now it's been driving around on Mars for 8 more years. So you have almost 20 years of keeping people employed for a cost of about $2.5 billion. And these are people that are gainfully employed with highly desirable skill sets that are transferable to other STEM fields. So I think if we try to see it more as like, this is a really highly beneficial jobs program that is also working us toward our future as a species, not just on Mars, but as a technologically literate species here on Earth, we can better understand why doing things like this is important.
Yeah, I remember someone discussing, I can't remember who it was, but discussing sort of like the space race, right? And how, you know, there was people still at the time sort of talking about how, I suppose, unimportant it was to actually get to the moon. What is the point? What are we even trying to do? And it's this idea of creating a problem for these scientists, right? Creating a situation where they actually have a problem to contend with. And then once they've finished, these incredible scientists, these incredible engineers, these minds go work at other institutions, go work at other industries and actually do bring in money. So it doesn't necessarily have to be a 1+1=2 sort of scenario. It's a bit further down the line. I suppose that's a little bit hard for people to grasp, and rightly so, I suppose, right? So,
yeah.
And there is a sort of philosophical context to astronomy, which I guess people love or people loathe, I suppose, because it's a little bit tenuous, like I said. What do you think is what do you think is the philosophical importance of humans as a species going out there and seeing, answering questions, the biggest questions we can possibly answer?
I think that it really helps us put humans in the context of the universe. Like, we want to know if we're alone. I think for selfish reasons, like you pointed out before, but also just the general curiosity of what else is out there. And we've explored so much of the Earth at this point that I don't think it holds a lot of the same intrigue as it did, say, 100 years ago to people. Because you can go on Instagram and see pictures of people all over the world, like on your phone. It's right there. But when you start seeing things like pictures of Jupiter or pictures of comets that are coming through the solar system or pictures of, you know, now we can image planets around other stars, which blows my mind. That's something that we don't necessarily get to see every single day. Certainly not people that are, you know, not working in astronomy.
Absolutely.
And so it still holds this fascination of, this is something that feels so unreal. Like, I don't get to see this every single day. And I would hope that would make people curious and inspire them, rather than looking at a beautiful picture of a nebula thousands of light years away and thinking, oh, I can't believe my taxpayer dollars paid for this. Like, that makes me feel sad for people with that attitude, because I don't know how you could see that and not be inspired. Like, I remember, I must have been maybe 5 or 6 or something like that, when Hubble Space Telescope took the picture of the pillars of creation.
Right, yes. Very famous image.
Yeah. And that came out on the cover of Sky and Telescope magazine. I remember my grandfather giving me that. And that was probably one of the big things to get me into astronomy as a kid, because that was pre-Mars even. I was already obsessed with space, and then Sojourner is what made me hone in on Mars. But he would give me issues of Sky and Telescope and Nat Geo and stuff like that. And that picture, I just remember it had such a huge impact on me. And then amazingly, like, fast forward 25 years, I ended up working at the university with the person that targeted that image. And I sent him a message, because I didn't realize he had done it. And then there was like a poster in our lobby that had his name on it that was like, congratulations for the 25th anniversary of the Pillars of Creation image. And so I sent him a message and I was like, hey, I know this is kind of random, but like, you indirectly inspired me to come into this job. And now we get to work together. And, you know, thank you from like 5-year-old me. And he just thought that was so wonderful to get to hear that from someone directly.
Yeah, and think of the sheer number of stories and things like this that have occurred many, many times from these sort of, like you said, small moments of inspiration and you know, just a feeling that, you know, this image can really, really change a person's entire trajectory in their existence. And that is a huge sort of philosophical reflection to take, that's for sure. The other thing as well, you obviously having worked for NASA, which is a government body, it's a government institution, the face of sort of space travel and I guess our research associated with space is changing a little bit because we have companies like SpaceX and Blue Origin and things along those lines. How do you feel about, I guess, what was typically a government job with NASA and with sort of the European organizations, government organizations? How do you feel that changing and going into the actual company sector, into business?
I think there's a little bit of a misconception from the outside that this is new. Mm-hmm. And part of it is new. You know, we haven't had billionaires building their own rockets and launching things into space before. So that part is pretty cool. But NASA has been working with commercial companies as subcontractors since its inception. You know, a private company, essentially multiple private companies essentially built the space shuttle. Most of the things that you see on the space station are built by various commercial companies, but those are government funded contracts. Mm-hmm. And now we have the ability for people, if they have enough money and enough ingenuity, or they can find enough investors, that they can start launching things into space themselves. And that's the biggest difference. Like, SpaceX does get corporate money and government money to do the stuff they do, for example. But they're doing it in a way that is completely different from sort of the traditional way things were done before. And there's something about it that has really garnered enthusiasm from the general public. I think because it allows a personality to be attached to these things that we don't necessarily get from NASA. And that's my biggest complaint about sort of the face that NASA has to put forward. And they're trapped in this as a government entity, so I understand why. But they're literally doing the coolest thing in the universe. Mm-hmm. And they don't seem to be allowed to convey that in a way where people get to show off their enthusiasm and their passion in like a genuine manner. But then you talk to someone like Elon Musk, who just goes on about how much he wants to get humans to Mars. And he's really passionate about this thing, and he has a goal, and he has a way of like rallying people behind him that, regardless of whatever opinion you might have about SpaceX or Elon personally or anything, because I know there's a lot of opinions out there, you have to admire how much he's been able to get people excited about this. And I definitely saw a transition while I was working at universities from students saying, I want to work for NASA, to students saying, I want to work for SpaceX.
Wow.
And that's that's a huge shift.
Yeah, that's a really big shock. You know, I did my undergraduate in physics as well. And when I was at university, I remember sort of people that were either doing work for NASA or associated with NASA or trying to go work with NASA. And they were just sort of discussing exactly what you were talking about there, like this. Because it being a government body, they can't say the things that they want to say. They can't make any outlandish promises. They can't, you know, there's so many things that they're having to be careful of, sort of minding their tongue. And I guess that is the appeal of people like Elon Musk, because he can say the most outrageous things he wants associated with Mars, and it's totally okay. He's the boss.
Yeah, he can launch a car into space, you know. Yeah, and NASA would never do that.
Exactly.
And you know, he can engage with people in a different way as well. There's I had a thought and I lost it. I guess one of the other things that NASA suffers from as a government entity is that it's really hard to have a consistent focus on a goal, because every time a new presidential administration comes in, they tend to scrap everything that the old one wanted to do and come out with a new idea. So, I mean, in the last 15 years or so, it's been like moon, Mars, asteroids, we're back to the moon again under this presidential administration. And these projects take so long that you can't do them in a single administration. It's just not technically possible. That might change now that we have these commercial companies that have such a specific focus. Like, they might be able to make this happen faster and with more agility. But it's for some goals, you can't. Like, we can't design a human mission to Mars and get humans to Mars in a 4-year time span. Like, that is just technically not possible, at least not right now. But if you are a billionaire with a single focus and you just funnel all of your money and resources to sending humans to the moon or sending them to Mars, like, that gives you such a leg up because you can keep this focus longer than NASA can. And, you know, that's not something that we can blame NASA for. Like, it's just the predicament that they're caught in. So they managed to do really amazing things. Like, I think NASA accomplishes so much within the confined bounds that they get stuck in as a government entity. And it's quite impressive compared to maybe almost any other government entity.
Yeah, they get shackled sort of thing.
Yeah.
You know, I sort of on that topic, the most important question of all, what do you think about the sort of current push to get to Mars? Do you think it is, what's the correct way to word this? I was about to say, do you think it's a wise idea to go to Mars? But you can answer that in a few different ideas. Do you think it's something that humans should be endeavoring for, is to actually get humans on Mars? Or do you think it's sort of unimportant and these sort of rover missions are good enough? What's your sort of standpoint there?
I think humans should absolutely go to Mars. I might be biased in this regard, but what we can do with the rovers is so incredibly limited. They're incredible pieces of technology, but what it took Opportunity 15 years to do on Mars, a human could probably do in the span of a couple of weeks. Right. And our technology isn't good enough to replace the experience and intuition of a human geologist stepping out and looking around and being able to pick up a rock and, you know, look at it a bunch of different angles. We can only dig down, you know, a few centimeters with the sampling tools that we have right now. And if we want to really answer the question of whether or not there was life on Mars, if this was the case 4 billion years ago, we're probably going to have to dig a lot deeper than that to find the evidence of that life. So I think to be able to definitively answer the question of whether or not life had Mars, unless we happen to catch a sample of it with the Perseverance rover, which is going to send samples back to Earth in the late 2020s or so.
Okay.
I think we're definitely going to have to send humans there just to answer that question. And it also helps us demonstrate that we have the ability to do this. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't think we should just sit here and be complacent when we have these other planets that are within reach and we can go explore them. And it gives us that next little piece of something to drive us forward. Like, let's go explore. Let's see what's at this next place. And once we've learned how to do that, where can we go after that? Like, what's the next place in the solar system that we want to start exploring as humans?
Yeah, I found it, you know, really interesting. And back to sort of what we were saying at the start of the podcast, how Mars really just captures the attention of humans in a way that everywhere else just doesn't, is how many people were volunteering to go to Mars, you know, knowing completely it was a dangerous thing to do. And people were saying how crazy these people must be and potentially, but the thing that struck me the most was how sort of passionate people were about going to Mars and space exploration as a whole. So I suppose the sort of crystal ball question, the looking into the future question, do you think it will happen, first of all, because you've sort of voiced that you think it should happen, but do you think it will happen? And not only that, who's going to be the ones to do it? Is it going to be NASA or is it going to be a private company? And when we do it, what's it going to look like? Is it going to be sort of the Mars One idea of a one-way journey, or is it going to be sort of a more NASA-inspired idea of going there for a short amount of time then coming back?
I think it will happen. I certainly hope it happens in my lifetime.
Absolutely.
And I'm concerned that it becomes an asymptote for NASA. Like, it's a goal that we never actually accomplish because it keeps getting pushed farther and farther back with other things happening in the interim, like the Lunar Gateway or the moon, or deciding that we don't want to send humans, or we need to do more and more tests to make sure that this is safe for humans, and get caught sort of in our own struggles to make sure that everything is going to be 100% safe when we have to accept the fact that it's not going to be. But like you said, there's people out there that are completely willing to drop everything in their life and hop on a spaceship on a one-way trip, knowing that they would most likely die to go to Mars. But people do that every day here on Earth too, right? People go skydiving, they climb Mount Everest, they go scuba diving. Like, we do stuff every day where we could die. And part of it's the thrill and the adventure and like accomplishing a life goal. And so if this is something that these people are willing to take the risk upon themselves to do, we should let them do it. And that's where, again, you get kind of, you get sort of constrained by being a government entity. Like the government certainly doesn't want to launch a mission to Mars where the crew ends up dying. Like that is terrible optics. If Elon Musk sends a mission to Mars where some people die, it's still terrible, but the optics are not the same. And so I almost feel like Elon will send people to Mars first just because he can. Like he has the ability to do that on a faster timeline just from the resources available to him. And part of me almost wants it to be that way because I think it will completely change the narrative of space exploration in a way that it becomes much more relatable to people in their day-to-day life. Like this person went out, started a bunch of businesses, became a billionaire, and then decided that he was going to go to Mars and accomplished this goal.
And did it.
And yeah, I think that that's just a really amazing possibility. And I kind of want to see that happen.
I mean, that's something I've definitely not thought of either. There's like, it is so difficult for a government to send people on this sort of dangerous, you know, like we've discussed, like very high chance of death. Whereas for, if it's a private institution, then they've just got to sign, they've just got to get the right people to sort of sign the contract and be happy to do it. And that, again, that's another facet that I've never really thought about. And yeah, like you said, I certainly hope it happens in my lifetime. And what is, if that is the case, what is Elon's plan? Do you know, is it sort of to colonize? Is it to go for a shorter trip?
I mean, I think his goal is to have permanent human bases on Mars. So he wants to start sending infrastructure like in the mid 2020s, sending these starships with the stuff that you need to start actually making the permanent structures on the surface, generating the fuel to be able to refuel the starships to come back to Mars, to back to Earth from Mars, and then have this sort of cyclical thing of people, cargo, stuff comes back.
Back forth, yeah.
And it gives us an interesting opportunity. Like if the national space agencies, international space agencies had the ability to partner with someone like Elon on projects like this, maybe we could expedite Mars exploration for everybody, not just humans, but, you know, bringing back samples from Mars when he's sending these resupply missions back, sending more advanced rovers because, you know, Starship can carry something like, I forget what it is, many, many metric tons of cargo to Mars. Whereas when we send these rovers, they're, you know, a couple thousand kilograms. They're, it's not a lot because it's so expensive to launch them. And very complicated to land them.
Of course.
So I feel like there's an opportunity here where, you know, what if instead of funneling $2.5 billion toward another rover, we funneled $2.5 billion toward working with SpaceX to make this mission a reality instead of like bringing up all these concerns about the ways that they're doing things. Because there's a lot of concerns expressed, you know, by like more traditional engineers. Like, okay, if those are your concerns, why don't we funnel money toward that to help them? Because we're trying to achieve the same goal at the end of the day. We want to send humans to Mars and we want to explore Mars. So let's do it together.
Yeah, makes sense. I mean, I don't really want to change tracks too much because I could speak about Mars all day and I'm sure you could as well. But we are getting to about the last 15 minutes of the podcast. So I did want to mention one more thing before we finish up, which is what you're doing currently, the work you're doing currently. You're still, from what I read, working with sort of imaging, no?
I am, but I work for an Earth imaging company right now. I still do Mars stuff like separate from my current job, but I've come back to Earth a little bit, I guess, with Earth orbiting satellites.
And what are you doing?
I work for a company called Planet Labs, and we operate the largest constellation of Earth imaging satellites in orbit. We've got about 150 or so that are operating right now. I think in total we've launched over 300, and most of these are small CubeSats that are about the size of a loaf of bread. And they go up and they're intentionally designed to have a relatively short lifespan compared to bigger traditional satellites because they're much cheaper, they're much smaller. And over time we deorbit them, so they burn up in the atmosphere, and we replace them with new technology. So we're constantly iterating, you know, improving sensors, improving our telescopes, improving accuracy of the way we navigate them and things like that. And so it's given us this really unique ability to image the entire landmass of the Earth every single day at pretty high resolution. It's 3 meter resolution, which means we can see things that are, you know, like the size of like about a semi truck and larger on the surface of the planet every day.
Wow. That's incredible. I didn't know that was even possible. That's amazing. Yeah. That's so much. And what is sort of, I mean, I guess it's kind of a silly question because there's 1,001 different things you could do with it, but what is the purpose of so much imaging so constant?
Well, so the motto of the company is "See change, change the world." And the idea was the Earth is changing so quickly every single day from all sorts of things, human processes, natural processes, that the idea of a static map just isn't sufficient anymore. And we can't really get an idea of how all of these different things are interacting with each other without being able to see them. So it gives you a lot of really great benefits, like the Earth is really cloudy in a lot of places a lot of the time. And so if you only fly over and try to image a place like once a month, for example, that image could be cloudy for some significant portion of the year, especially like Seattle, for example. It's really hard to take satellite images of Seattle because it's cloudy and rainy a lot. But if you're shooting it every single day, that gives you way more opportunities to catch cloud-free gaps in the middle of all of that. It also gives you a log record of activity in terms of things like natural disasters. So instead of having to see that a disaster happened and take images after the fact, you have that record already to see what happened leading up to it, the event itself, and then being able to plan your response strategy after that. So that's a really big one, because usually you might not have images of an area where you had, say, a landslide or a hurricane for months or maybe even years before that event happened. And this way you can catch it hopefully in the span of a few days before maybe even the day that the thing happens and then right after it.
Right. And I'm going to ask, this is going to be absolutely a horrible question because it's just going to be so difficult. And this is like no doubt centuries of work and into one question. But how do you image the Earth? How do you do it? Because obviously these satellites are going extremely fast. And you said, well, there was 150 odd of them, which is a lot, but versus the size of the Earth is very, very, very tiny, right?
Yeah.
So what is the sort of method of imaging the Earth? How is it done?
So for us in particular, we take advantage of the motion of the Earth in our favor. So all of these satellites, they're orbiting essentially in a line. I realize I'm making hand gestures now, but people listening can't see my hand gestures.
You can do both.
So they're orbiting essentially in a ring, like one right after the other, and they fly in this trail, and they're imaging constantly, essentially, as long as they're on the day side of the planet. So they're snapping a bunch of images, and as they're going along in that line, the Earth is rotating beneath them. So it's almost acting like a gigantic line scanner. The Earth is going by and the satellites are imaging as they're moving along in their orbit around the Earth in the other direction. And so from that, we can build up this activity, or sorry, these images, line by line by line, going across the entire planet.
And then from there, is it like, do companies sort of buy this information? I suppose, do scientific organizations take this information to learn more about, I suppose, climate change? I can imagine there'd be loads of companies that would want this information, like agricultural ones, to know about weather patterns, things like that. So what happens with the images thereafter?
We do have a lot of agricultural work being done because the images are frequent enough and high resolution enough that you can actually see individual smallholder farms as opposed to looking at, like, you know, the state of corn across masses. All of Iowa, for example. And that's not something we've really been able to do before at like a high temporal frequency. We have a ton of scientists that use the data to look at effects of climate change. Some people that use it for social things like monitoring human migration in different areas. We have some folks that are looking at, like we have humanitarian groups that look at refugee camps to see how those are expanding over time and monitoring other sort of human atrocities, because it acts as like this global source of truth. Like the images don't lie. So if they look at the images, you could have, say, China try to say that they're not expanding camps in particular areas, and you can look at the satellite image from the day before and say, well, we can see between yesterday and last week you built X number of new buildings, for example. So there's a lot of different ways that you can use this information, and it is a flood of data. There's so much of it. Absolutely. That even in the research community, sometimes people are like, oh, I don't even know where to start. There's so much of this. So I'm excited to see what more and more researchers do as they begin to grasp the idea of having access to daily coverage like this, because we've had daily imaging of the Earth for a long time with different NASA satellites, but the resolution difference is really, really extreme. Right. Like, we're talking 500 meter and lower resolution compared to 3 meter. Mm-hmm. So it's going to take like a huge rethinking in terms of like, oh man, this is an entirely new data source for me to work with. Mm. How am I going to apply this to my research? But we have people at universities all over the world that are using it right now. We have a deal with NASA to actually make our data available to any NASA Earth Science researcher. Mm-hmm. So that's a new thing that we've done this year, which I'm really excited about, because it opens up the access to literally hundreds, if not thousands, of more people to start digging into the data. And like, my role is basically, I'm a scientist at Planet that is trying to help other scientists learn how to use this data. So we're suddenly about to get hopefully a lot more scientists on board, and I'm really excited.
Right. It's why I love sort of speaking to people like you and learning about, I suppose, new technologies and new changes in the world, because, you know, that's something I would never have thought about, like, satellites and the association that will have with like atrocities and, you know, things that are more sort of political. You wouldn't think that they'd have sort of an association, but obviously they do. It's like this sort of eye of truth in a certain way. And I guess that does sort of beg the question, you know, you are working for the company, so I don't expect you to put your foot in it too much, but is there sort of like negativities of this much imaging? Is there is certainly people out there who probably don't like that this is occurring, I'm sure, and I'm sure you've heard about that, being in the job that you have. But do you think there are sort of problems with so much, surveillance is the wrong word because it's not like it's cameras on the street, but so much watching?
This concern comes up a lot. I think anytime that there's discussion of imaging the Earth from space, you have people that are concerned about how this data will be used, not just from Planet, but in general.
Right.
And, you know, the goal of a lot of this is not nefarious at all when you're talking about trying to image the Earth from space. You know, whether it's a company or a government like NASA, like, they're doing things like monitoring the weather and looking at the oceans and keeping track of boats to like make sure there's not illegal fishing going on, and you know, keeping track of these humanitarian crises, like I mentioned. There's only so much you can do to try and keep images like this from being used by bad actors. And like at Planet, we do have measures in place where we try to keep the actual imagery. Like, we won't sell it to groups that we don't think are ethically aligned with what we're trying to do, for example. But there are concerns that people have about, like, how can this data be used? And, you know, from a standpoint of either the wrong people looking at it or people that could use it for surveillance, like you're saying. And like, our images are intentionally too low of a resolution to like see license plates on your cars, for example.
Wow.
The government can do that, but we're looking at patterns of life at this resolution. So like, we're not looking necessarily at an individual car to say that's a red Toyota Corolla. It's more like, oh, we can see there were a lot of people in this area yesterday, and today there's like no cars in this parking lot. So it's very, very different things. So yeah, I hope that people understand that the goal of a lot of this is beneficial. Like, we want to help the Earth. We want to fight climate change. Yep, we want to stop atrocities that are happening in other countries. You know, we don't have the power to do that as a company that takes images of the Earth, but hopefully this data can help empower the people that can make the policy decisions and, you know, law enforcement decisions or whatever has to come into play to stop these different things from happening.
you know, we've been talking. You've taught me more than a handful of things that I didn't know, that's for sure. And, you know, I can definitely feel sort of your passion, your genuine passion for Mars and just sort of scientific endeavor for humanity as a whole. So there's sort of always the final important question that I like to give to people in your position is like, I guess the sort of magic wand scenario, right? So you yourself, you've worked with Mars for many years. You've had passion for Mars for even longer. What would you like to see changed, or what would you like to see happen sort of within the next decade or two decades that will sort of, I suppose change the world associated with Mars, change the way people think about it, get more information? What would you like to see change? Is it funding? Is it just the way people perceive it? What would you think? Difficult question.
Yeah, it's big. I mean, I think public perception and funding are tied together in a way, so mm-hmm. I would like to see both of those change. If our goal is really to send humans to Mars, we need funding to do that. We need the singular vision to do that. And mm-hmm. sort of like the Apollo program was like, this is your goal. Everything we're going to do for the next decade is to achieve that goal.
This is it. Yeah.
And we need that kind of drive again to actually make it happen rather than just being a goal on paper that gets kicked down the street, you know, every time it has a chance. But part of getting more funding for that kind of thing is heavily tied to public interest. If the public is more excited about space, then their political representatives are more inclined to advocate for mm-hmm. that. And they see it as something that, you know, gives them brownie points. Like, oh, my constituents either work in space fields, you know, a place like Texas, for example, tends to support space exploration very heavily because you have a lot of employees that work at a place like Johnson Space Center and the various NASA subcontractors. But if you're in a place like, I don't know, Oklahoma, where there might not be anything that's affiliated with NASA, it might be harder to get people excited to want to support that kind of thing, because they don't necessarily see how it's impacting their day-to-day mm-hmm. life. So if we can help people understand why we explore space and why it's important and why this should be a goal for humans that we want to achieve in the near future, not something to do 50, 100 years from now, then that can in turn help the funding situation. And then hopefully maybe get us all excited again. Like, I would love to see the excitement come back toward Mars like we had trying to get humans to the moon during the Apollo program.
Yeah, well, I mean, that was fighting sort of the Russians at that time, wasn't it? So if only sort of Russia or China or North Korea said they were trying to get to Mars, then maybe maybe the US would feel different about it. Who knows?
Yeah.
All right, Tanya, thank you very much for this. I really appreciate your time. It's been awesome talking to you.
Oh, thanks for having me. This was great.
If you enjoyed this episode of the podcast, please subscribe to us. Go to any of our social media accounts or website. Tell your friends, tell your grandparents. Do anything you can do in your power to help us out, because it will allow us to continue doing this podcast for everybody, which we greatly appreciate. Thank you for the support, and see you next time.